Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lahav Harkov, senior contributing editor and diplomatic correspondent, and I am here this week with Tzvika Klein, our Jewish world reporter. Hi, Tzvika. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lahav.
So once again, we have Nasrallah barking at us about our gas.
Right.
Yeah, so the night before we're recording this, Amos Hochstein, who's the U.S. envoy on gas issues, had a secret meeting with Lapid. You know, it's interesting. On my beat, this is like a huge thing that I've been writing about for since late 2020, so, you know, almost 2 years now, about how Lebanon and Israel are involved in this dispute, where our border is in the sea, and who has access to what gas. And I don't think that people in Israel were that interested until Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, started threatening Israel over it. What do you think?
Well, I'll tell you why. I mean, my theory is every time, you know, there's something big like the gas deal or the Kotel deal, which is in my beat, you know, people just like tune out because it's so complicated. Like they don't, you know, they don't, their brain just can't deal with all this stuff, so they don't get into it. By the way, like, you know, I did a little bit of homework to read about it so I would, you know, understand a little bit more. And, you know, it's fascinating. And I didn't even realize that since 2020, you know, the U.S. has been, you know, trying to mediate between us and Lebanon. And I didn't realize that the guy doing it was, you know, born in Israel and had a really Israeli name.
Yeah, Amos Hochstein. Yeah. It's interesting because I felt the same way about Iran, for example. Like when the Iran deal happened, I was Knesset reporter. So I was really reporting on the deal itself. And it sounded like a pretty bad deal to me since everybody was saying it was bad. But I sort of did not understand the details until I had to. And now I feel like I could write a PhD about it. So
exactly right. Because like, again, like, you know, as a reporter, you have to understand like the nuance between like they changed like one of the, pieces of some specific deal or contract. And you know, that may be dramatic because it has like very big implications. But people have, you know, when I was covering the whole issue in the UK with Jeremy Corbyn. And every other day there was like a news story about anti-Semitism. And, you know, I tried to follow, but it's difficult to live in, you know, a different country and then follow something in the other country and understand actually all the, you know, nuance and background and political issues that, you know, we're probably not aware of.
Yeah. Yeah. So I will try to make the case for this Lebanon issue, why it's important, which, you know, Israel has been pumping gas from the sea for several years now, and only recently became an exporter of gas. So we use the gas for our own consumption, and hopefully we'll use more of it soon, because still it's only about half of our gas, and we still import coal, which is, of course, terrible for the environment. But we're also exporting gas to Egypt and to Jordan, which makes money for us, a lot of tax money for the government, which is then supposed to go into education and welfare. That's part of, like, this is going back like almost 10 years already when the Knesset passed laws to regulate the gas. Now, the border with Lebanon, it would only be about 2% of our territorial waters. That's the dispute. So it's not huge. But if we have Hezbollah breathing down our necks and threatening us and threatening the gas rigs that are drawing that gas out of the sea, it could hurt investments. It could hurt future exploration. We are secure for a long time in our gas because the law that was passed leaves 50% of the gas for Israel and only the other half to be exported. But, you know, it's long term thinking, which is also something that Israelis don't excel at. So,
But were there any like surveys done or like about what Israelis think about this?
Speaking anecdotally. Yeah. I don't think when people really cared was when I was covering it in the Knesset and the laws were being passed, and then there was a whole campaign saying that the laws were benefiting the rich and not actually giving enough tax money to the, you know, to benefit Israelis. Which, you know, now that the law passed a long time ago and it's in place, I thought that they were wrong. And I thought that, you know, our laws are a lot stricter with the gas exploration companies than, say, the laws in Europe or in the US. So in theory, we are getting a greater benefit from our gas than other countries in the Western world do from their gas. But that's a matter of opinion, I guess.
Now, Amos Hochstein, I'm curious, like, what's his deal? Like, what's his, you know, he's, I mean, according, you know, I did a little bit of reading about him. He's modern Orthodox. His parents were Anglo, grew up in Israel, served in the IDF, and then went back. And, you know, he's done a bunch of stuff in the U.S., in the Obama administration, et cetera. I mean, I find it fascinating how, you know, people actually represent like one country and they have such a, you know, complex identity.
That's the beauty of countries that accept immigrants, right? I mean, it's in Israel too, we have people in very high positions that grew up in the Soviet Union or in Ethiopia or anywhere else. You know, so America mostly embraces immigrants, and he had a talent and he had an expertise and he got in. I don't know a lot about him beyond his Wikipedia page, so to speak, because he's not someone who I've met in person, but I will say that he's very critical of Netanyahu. And I wrote about that when he entered this job with Biden. I had found some past quotes. But you know, so he still has a Israeli politics in him. But now, of course, he can't talk about that because he's in a position in the federal government.
Right, right. 100%. So you actually just published these, you know, a part. I mean, you know, there are all these, you know, parts of Kushner's new book and, you know, you different leaks of different parts. I just, you know, a few, I think yesterday, maybe I read a whole Jewy aspect of, like, you know, about
tell us a little bit about that. That was in the foreword, right?
It was in the foreword, yeah. It was just interesting how, like, he wrote about, you know, in first person about how he was going to meet his future father-in-law and for the first time. And it turns out 2 years before, he got a letter from Trump saying, when he was, you know, he was the publisher of The Observer. And in the letter, Trump said, you know, stop sending me your newspaper, because I guess they had some like list of influential, you know, influential, you know, leaders or something. And Trump wasn't high enough, as high as he thought he should be. So he said, stop sending me your crap newspaper, something like that. Something like, you know, very Trumpy.
Sounds like him. Yeah.
Yeah. And then 2 years later, he's meeting him and he said he was shaking. And he was going to tell him that his daughter was wanted to convert in order for them to get married. And he said, well, you know, I'm not quoting exactly, but he said, well, why does she need to convert? Everyone thinks I'm Jewish anyways. And in Israel, they love me and all the synagogues give me all these awards and this and that. And then he explained it to him that it was her decision. And it was interesting. He wrote about her conversion, how, like, you know, it was something that she actually really connected to. Like at the beginning, they were buying food for Shabbat, for Friday. By the way, Second Avenue Deli, is that a kosher place?
Yeah, I think of the famous delis, Second Avenue is the kosher one, and Katz's is not kosher one.
Oh, okay, So I got them mixed up. So they were buying food there, and then she said, "I want to cook for Shabbat." So I guess she learned how to, you know, kosher, etc.
So can I tell you on like a personal note, I grew up in Deal, New Jersey, which is like a beach community, and the Kushners had their summer home in New Jersey. So I didn't know Jared, but I knew Josh. We were like around the same age. I didn't know him when we weren't like friends or anything, but I just knew him because they would come to my shul in the summers. And not after I made Aliyah, like a couple years later, I guess, is when Jared and Ivanka got married. And then I would hear the gossip from my friends who were still going home to their parents for the holidays about, you know, what Ivanka wore, what kind of hat, beautiful hat she wore to shul that day. But people, and you know, and this was before they were like, at that time, they were like New York celebrities. You know what I mean?
It wasn't, it was like people, in the tabloids, in the New York tabloids.
Right. It was like very specific.
But it wasn't like international, you know, maybe like Jewish media a little bit, but that's it.
Yeah. So I would get these reports back from my friends, and people thought she was serious. I mean, you know, it's what you could judge externally because they weren't like they're making friends with everyone, but people thought she was very serious.
Well, it's usually like that, again, as someone that's been writing about the Jewish world and converts, you know, for a long time. Many times, you know, with couples that like one grew up being Jewish or even religious, and then the other, you know, the spouse converts. Many times, the person that converts is a lot more into Judaism or like serious about it than people who grew up Jewish, because, you know, they actually, you know, they make this, you know, very bold decision. I think also people at the beginning didn't think it was real, or that it would they'd continue actually being, you know, religious or semi-religious. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, like one of the parts of the book they were talking about, someone in the staff of the White House was saying, this is the first time anyone lit Shabbat candles in the residence of the White House. And, you know, that's a very, you know, that's a very serious and it's a beautiful thing, I think, yeah, that they were able to do that.
Yeah, I think so too. So I also got some of these excerpts. They were more on the political and diplomatic side. More about,
because you're the more serious person. I just like the gossip, you know.
I like it all, I have to tell you. Like when Yaakov is on this podcast, it is almost entirely no nonsense. I like a little bit of nonsense.
He's the boss.
Right. We did have a run where we kept talking about the Top Gun movie. But in any case, back to Jared. Okay. So he wrote a bunch, I mean, unsurprisingly, a bunch about the Trump peace plan and about the Abraham Accords. And we have a couple of good headlines in the Post. I mean, first we have that the Trump peace plan almost didn't happen because of Mahmoud Abbas. So mm-hmm. when the plan was completed, and about a week before Kushner and his team, which involved Ambassador Friedman and Avi Berkowitz, they wanted to release the plan in January 2020. So they had a final meeting with Trump where they were presenting it. And then Trump was like, so the Palestinians agree? And Kushner said, no, the Palestinians don't agree. Mm-hmm. And not only do the Palestinians not agree, but that's the point. Kushner didn't use the word trap, but I see it as it was a trap, basically, because, okay, if the Palestinians agree, great, but nobody thought they were going to agree. And then if they don't agree, then the Trump administration could go to their allies in the Arab world. They could go to, you know, the Emiratis mm-hmm. and the Saudis and the Bahrainis, et cetera, and say, look how stubborn the Palestinians are. You can't wait for them to say yes in order to normalize ties with Israel, because at that point, they really wanted normalization already, even though it wasn't a sure thing at all. Despite hearing that logic, Trump said, no, you have to call President Abbas. So then Kushner called Abbas, and Abbas refused to speak to Trump until the plan was already public. So, you know, Abbas's own, again, like being stubborn, he might have stopped the plan.
Or changed something.
So I thought that was really interesting.
There's all these also, you know, like leaks, and I'm sure, you know, you're also, you know, publishing other parts of the book. But
This podcast comes out on Thursday. On Friday, we're going to publish like an excerpt in full, like half a chapter or something like that, in the Jerusalem Post magazine.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. So, I mean, do you agree? I'm sure you've seen all these, you know, quotes or, you know, basically stating that Netanyahu wasn't, you know, supporting this deal, or Netanyahu, you know, asking to tone certain things down, or not wanting to promote the annexation, etc. I mean, is this something that you think is accurate?
No. So I read Friedman's book earlier this year, and I've spoken to Friedman many, many, many times. And then now I've read excerpts of Kushner's book that's dealing with the annexation issue. And also, by the time this podcast is out, I will have published that article as well. No, the problem was that Netanyahu was too enthusiastic about the annexation. He wanted to run with it full speed ahead. There were sort of two parts to it. First of all, when you look at the plan, right, it has a vague map that shows that more or less where Israelis live in Judea and Samaria could become part of Israel officially. What we call annexation or extending sovereignty is what the right prefers to call it.
Right.
And the idea in the plan was that Israel could do that basically from the beginning. But the what the Trump administration didn't understand, and at least according to these books, no one understood it, not Friedman, not Kushner, is that Netanyahu thought he was going to do that at the next cabinet meeting, which was like 3 days later. Right. And the basically, the Israel had a very prepared and detailed map of what it wanted to annex in the Jordan Valley, and it had a less detailed map of other parts of the West Bank where Israelis live. So they wanted to go ahead with the Jordan Valley, and then they would continue on the rest. And and Kushner then said, no, like, we're going to do it all at once. And Friedman, at least according to the book, Friedman did back him up. I know there's reports about, like, them contradicting each other and everything. I think there was a difference in tone. I think that Kushner was really, really mad at Bibi and felt that Bibi was doing something behind his back, sort of. And Friedman was more understanding. But I just went over his book a few hours before we're recording this to see. Friedman didn't give Netanyahu a green light. He also was surprised by Netanyahu's sort of moving so fast. He just, I think, was more understanding because he was more pro-annexation in general. And then the other thing is that the Trump administration was demanding that Netanyahu make concessions to the Palestinians together with the annexation. And that was the part where it was stuck, because Netanyahu wasn't agreeing to anything that the Trump administration wanted him to do. And so that was when, like, the deadline, which I believe was June 30th in 2020, that Netanyahu said he was going to do it by then. That deadline sort of passed without Trump's approval, because Netanyahu had not agreed to any of the steps they wanted him to take for the Palestinians. And remember, this was right before an election, so that probably would have hurt him in the election. And then the big headline on jpost.com about this excerpt is that the Trump administration actually said to Netanyahu, if you annex without coordinating it with us, without making any kind of concession to the Palestinians, we will not block any of the UN resolutions against you, even if they're sanctions.
Wow. Wow, that's dramatic.
That's very dramatic.
You read these books like they're Gemara.
Yes. Well, that's the thing with diplomacy, right? Is that, like, the word choice is very important. Although I will say that in the Trump administration, most of them did not operate like professional diplomats, and sometimes that was good. I mean, sometimes that was too.
I don't think the Abraham Accords could have happened if there weren't people who are, you know, who are out of the box, right, in business and into, like, you know, doing, I don't know, negotiations in a way that diplomats probably don't do. Anyways,
yeah, but I agree.
Speaking of negotiations, so the Russia Jewish agency crisis is still going on. And it's funny because people also tell me, wait, is there still a war in Ukraine?
And I
say, unfortunately, just like the public, you know, like, also, like, journalists are, like, bored of it in a way, but the war is still, you know, there's nothing really changed. So basically, there was this Israeli delegation that went out to Russia. Very weird delegation, I have to say. It's a group of, like, legal advisors for different ministries, mainly, you know, that's the type. And one of them is also representative of Pnina Tamanoshata, who is the minister for Aliyah and Absorption. And they met with on Monday with representatives of the Justice Ministry in Russia and the Foreign Ministry in Russia, and basically reached a dead end. And I'll just remind, basically, the Russian Justice Ministry sent a letter to the Jewish agency in Russia about a month ago, saying they have to close down their operations because they're violating different rules, different laws regarding privacy that have actually become more, they just changed the law in the past few weeks, and it's become a lot more serious. And a lot, you know, basically anyone who has any sort of international connection, and the Jewish agency is a very international organization, is in a problem and could potentially be considered a foreign agent. And if you're a foreign agent, you pretty much can't do anything. So, you know, basically, I spoke to a diplomatic source yesterday, and he said there's pretty much nothing to do anymore on the legal aspect. There's going to be a trial on the 19th, and the Jewish agency has lawyers who will, you know, hopefully try and defend them. But the only hope we have is kind of the diplomatic aspect of it. And I'm curious what you think, because definitely you know a lot more about diplomacy than me. But I mean, there are different talks about President Isaac Herzog mediating behind the scenes. He hinted that he was going to be involved in what's going on over here. Because, you know, at the end of the day, Russia is just trying to get rid of any sort of international influence. And they see the Jewish agency as that.
So I find it, first of all, interesting. I mean, this delegation was put together because they wanted to not escalate the issue. And if the Russians said it's just a legal issue, so they'll act like it's just a legal issue. But I don't think any of these people are experts in Russian law. Which is
they don't even speak Russian. They don't speak Russian.
So it's like, what kind of game are you playing? Like, that made no sense to me. I think it's an interesting, it's a dilemma, right? Because on the one hand, one of the like signature ways in which the Soviet Union oppressed Jews was by not letting them leave. And so we all have that sense, you know, and we're all very nervous about this because, you know, the Jewish agency is a major operator when it comes to leaving Russia to come to Israel. Now, there is a visa-free agreement between the countries, so someone in Russia could just fly to Israel without the Jewish agency and then go to the government office and make it official that they immigrated. But the Jewish agency is a major conduit, right?
Right. So, and it's also a symbol. It's also a symbol, you know, because of, you know, what went on before the 90s was, I mean, that's a big deal.
Right. So I think, you know, the government sort of has to decide how much it's going to put its foot down over this issue and this symbol, because on the other hand, like normal everyday Jewish life in Russia, schools, camps, synagogues are not really being harassed or shut down from what I understand. I mean, again, you'd know better than me, but, and so, you know, and you don't want to endanger them. And so I think that it's a really difficult and delicate thing. Now, I think that President Herzog has been a real diplomatic asset to Israel. I want to say surprisingly, I mean, not that I thought that he would do diplomatic damage, but I didn't think badly of him, but it's just not the role the president usually plays. Right.
Mm-hmm. So President Peres, in a way, you know, even when Netanyahu was prime minister, occasionally, like, you know, did certain things.
I think that Paris usually, when he did those things, was seen as like freelancing. Like, you know what I mean? Like Netanyahu was giving him the side eye. Like, why are you doing this?
Right.
You know, and now the Bennett and Lapid are using Herzog for the benefit of the government's sort of diplomatic policies. Right. I think that's great. I mean, he clearly has the skill and the ability to advance things for the good of the country. It's unique. It's different. You know, he's a former chairman of the Jewish agency. He's also someone who has international respect. Someone told me, when we were talking about like his involvement in Turkey, that throughout the Arab and Muslim world, people kind of respect that Herzog comes from a quote unquote dynasty. Like, it's interesting. I mean, Turkey's a democratic country, at least, you know, mostly.
In a way, right.
So I don't know. But apparently that people see him as almost like a prince, you know, and they kind of respect that, which I find interesting. I don't know how well that works in Russia per se, but he is someone who has a relatively high international profile. And also, unlike Lapid, he didn't say anything bad about Russia that I can think of. since the war began, I think he just kind of kept quiet.
By the way, I have to say that Lapid surprised me for the worse. I was sure that he would be like the perfect foreign minister. Like, this is a job that was created for him. He's a good speaker. He was on TV. He's charismatic. He speaks English. But like, he gets into these, you know, very dramatic fights or crises between with Poland and with Russia.
And I do think that was it. Like, I don't, I mean, mostly Lapid did do what people expected him to do. He was charming. Mm-hmm. You know, he got right. up and spoke, addressed the EU Foreign Affairs Council, and now the EU wants mm-hmm. to upgrade its relations with Israel to something that's called the Association Council. And this is an example of the kind of things that, like, I know a lot about, but are not actually that interesting to people. But it's upgrading, right, it's upgrading right, EU-Israel right. relations. I think that he has a sort of specific worldview on things that is very West-oriented, Western mm-hmm. democracy-oriented, which is not, it's not bad per se, but you have to know how to balance it. And
He's also a very classic second-generation Holocaust survivor, I think, you know?
Right, but it's not just that.
With Poland, that's a real issue.
Yes. I don't think we really explained the issue. So you want to just explain it briefly to our listeners?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, Poland, basically, I mean, even when he was chairman of the opposition, I think that's when it started, basically. There's a whole issue of Israel-Poland relations regarding all these mainly Israeli, but also Jewish delegations to Poland. And to visit a lot of people,
concentration camps.
The concentration camps and Holocaust memorials, and many people in Israel feel that the Polish are kind of trying to change the narrative and add in all these words that, you know, they're also the victim, and as they were, by the way. But you know, the question is, you know, how different? And there's a very big dramatic difference between being a Pole and a Polish Jew during the Holocaust. And so there was this whole Twitter, you know, fight between Lapid and the ambassador then to Israel. And it just, ever since, you know, there are all these laws in Poland regarding restitution, and they're trying to make it more difficult for Jews to kind of re-own or re-get, you know, the rights for places that either their families or organizations own different real estate. So, as prime minister, it's actually worse. And there are no, if I understand correctly, there are no delegations at the moment of Israeli schools to Poland, which is something very popular. And it's not,
it's weird to call it popular, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I will say, so when I was talking about Lapid being sort of West oriented, so Netanyahu had this policy where he tried to really court and nurture a relationship with the, with like the central to Eastern European members of the EU. Mm-hmm. And they're not in all the countries, but in a couple of them, like Poland and Hungary, there's like some democratic backsliding. And so there was a lot of criticism that like Netanyahu was cozying up to authoritarians, quote unquote. And you would get that criticism like from, you know, Foreign Policy magazine and things like that, but you would also get it from Lapid. So for Lapid, yeah. like I do think that the Poland thing came from like his kishkas, that just like as the son right. of a Holocaust survivor, like he just could not tolerate the Poles pretending that they were as big victims as the Jews. But I do think that there's also an element of that. So let's move on to our guests. So next week, Likud and Labor are both having primaries. How do you feel about primaries? Should parties have them or not?
I mean, I'm depressed that like there, you know, most, I don't know if most, but many Israeli parties don't have primaries.
Yeah, I agree.
But also like I have no patience for primaries because as a journalist, like when there's primaries, like every single person that ever like just knows how to vote thinks they can, you know, be a candidate for a certain party and expects you to write about them.
And you're so like, I write about the Jewish world. If you're a primary for the Zionist Congress, let me know.
There's an element. Exactly. Right. So I don't know. But yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's like disappearing. And I think it's a problem.
Yeah, I think it's better that parties allow greater accountability to their supporters. And that it's a problem that we have so many parties that sort of revolve around one person. Even if those parties end up having perfectly fine policies, you know, that this is a weakness in Israeli
democracy. Or even good people, like good representatives. Yeah. But, you know, I would just prefer it to be more democratic and less.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's, I believe, four parties that have primaries. There's Likud, Labor, Meretz, and Religious Zionists. There's mm-hmm. some form of primary, I think, in the Hadash party, which is one of the parties making up the joint list. And next week we have Likud and Labor. And so we've brought on candidates from each party. First, we have Fleur Chassan Nachum from Likud. She's also the deputy mayor of Jerusalem, to talk to us about why she supports Likud, why she thinks she'd be a good candidate. And then after that, we have Yaya Fink, who is a longtime social activist in Israel and has been involved in politics in the Labor Party for at least a decade, I think. And he's also talking to us about the primary in the Labor Party. And you got into it with him about being a religious Zionist while also being a very well-known outspoken representative of the left in Israel, which I thought was pretty interesting. So here we go. So our guest this week is Fleur Chassan Nachum. She is the deputy mayor of Jerusalem and also a candidate in the Likud primary next week. Welcome, Fleur.
Hi, Lahav. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast.
So I want to ask you, Likud is having the primary next week, but it's not having a primary for its leader.
That's right.
Why do you think nobody dares run against Netanyahu for party leader?
Well, first of all, we had a leadership primary a couple of years ago when he ran against Gideon Sar, and Gideon Sar got 27% of the votes. So in terms of the rules of the party, he didn't have to run again. And secondly, because nobody is as strong as Netanyahu in the leadership of the Likud. So anybody who wants to run against him knows that they're not going to win. So that puts off a lot of people when they actually have absolutely no belief that they can win. And that's why we're in a situation where there are primaries for the list, because the Likud, as opposed to many other parties, is a democratic party. It's a party with rules and regulations. It's got the largest membership of any party in the country. It's got a court system. It's got an appellate system. And the last primaries were held in January 2019. And so after four elections, it was decided by the leadership of the party and the different institutions of the party that we needed to do primaries. And that's why they're happening and not the primaries for the leadership.
Other parties or other figures in politics have criticized the primary system in Likud. Likud is one of the few parties to have a primary in this election. I believe there's four, Likud, Labor, Meretz, and Religious Zionists. But the criticism has been that the primary system in Likud has allowed a lot of like special interest groups to have an overly sort of loud voice, whether it's, you know, taxi drivers or other the airport workers unions and all kinds of things like that, and that the system is corrupt. What do you respond to people like that?
Well, first of all, you know, anybody can join the Likud if they're believed to have the values of the Likud. And so, you know, you're in a workers union and you bring in 1,000 workers from your workers union, and that strengthens you politically. That's politics. I mean, you can do that on a national level, you can do that on a local level, you can do that on any level. It's simply politics. You want support, you convince people, you become a leader of your small little group, and that's how it works. Now, some groups, like in America, for example, of course, have special interests. The taxi drivers lobby, but you've also got the liberals in the Likud who believe in, you know, liberal economic policies, and they do their lobbying. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that happens everywhere. And you have to understand the Likud, because it's the largest party, you know, new people like me actually have a chance of being in the Knesset. When you look at smaller parties like Meretz and Labor today, you know, it's always the same five people doing musical chairs. There's very, very little room for new blood in these parties, because they're small parties and they're always run by the same people in those parties. So, you know, the Likud, first of all, is democratic in every sense. In other words, you bring people in that you strengthen yourself. And secondly, it's a big party, so there are many different opportunities. Also, the Likud has got a constitution. And so, you know, there are decisions made that sometimes people say, well, they're not good decisions, but then you can go to the Likud Bet Din, to a court, and appeal them. And one of the examples actually happened to show actually how democratic Likud is, that a decision was made by the court that in the regional districts, where normally, or for the last time, it was only central committee members who could vote for the regional placements, Bibi and some other people pushed for that not to be in the hands of the region, of the central committee members, but to be in the hands of all the members. And that is seen to have been definitely a hit for the central committee membership and a win for the wider, you know, Likud membership. So these things are happening all the time. But again, there's a court system, there's a constitution, there's rules, there's regulations. It's a proper ecosystem and infrastructure.
So in Likud, there seems to be general or public, I would say, public consensus over Netanyahu's leadership, in contrast with the election, where it almost seems like the entire election is about yes, Bibi or no, Bibi. But of course, it's a very, very competitive field for the primaries. People are competing for it's more seats than any of the other parties in the primaries, but there's still many times over the amount of people who are competing for the amount of seats. So what are the fault lines? What are the big issues that people are debating in these primaries?
Yeah. So I'll tell you what a big one is in the Likud, and that is the legal system. That's been a big topic in these primaries. How do we reform the legal system? There are some people who've, you know, expressed themselves about burning it down and starting from scratch. And then there are the more moderate people who talk about fixing it, improving it, evolving it. And so that's been a big issue. The other issue that Bibi has, I think, taken the primary, or is going to be taking the general elections, which of course is also spoken about in the primaries, is the cost of living. Especially, you know, with all the price rises. And again, you know, Bibi is the person that brought Israel from a mainly socialist rooted economy into a free market economy. And there's a lot of talk about continuing that work, continuing to evolve, breaking monopolies, opening the markets, opening imports, et cetera, et cetera. So those are two big issues. Other issues, of course, is settlement in Judea and Samaria, building in Jerusalem, which is something that I talk about a lot. So these are the central issues. I think that pretty much covers what people are talking about in the primaries and standing up for.
There have been some very colorful candidates using some, you know, not the cleanest language, not what I would consider parliamentary language. And they get a lot of attention. So how do you think it's possible to sort of stand out when you, for example, are not someone like that?
that's actually one of my challenges. How do people who try and keep a sort of a standard of decency and ethics, how do you, you know, when it's the people who, you know, the headlines about the people making the very kind of outlandish comments, it definitely is a challenge. But actually, I think that people are thirsty for the more statesmanlike approach. I think people are a little bit tired. I think people are a little bit ashamed of some of the more colorful language coming out of Likud, because most people in Likud are decent people, people of ethics and morals, people who care for the country, patriots. And so, you know, when you actually meet people face to face and they understand, you know, who I am, the work that I've done in my past and how I've expressed myself, are excited by somebody who can, you know, who can pull up the standards.
And you're running for one of the women's slots in Likud. Can you explain how that works, and also why you decided to do that instead of running as an immigrant, which you also had the option to do?
Yes. So, you know, we had to analyze this very carefully. And that's another positive thing to say about the Likud, that they give an opportunity for new blood to come into the system. And they've also got female representation secured spots, to make sure that it doesn't end up being, you know, a list full of men. And so I could have run either in the new immigrant spot or in the woman's spot, in the new woman's spot. The new woman's spot is a bit higher on the list. So that's number 25. And the new immigrant is number 33. And again, with all the dealings that happened in court, it was decided by the court system of the Likud that MKs who've served in the past can run for the new immigrant spot, but they can't run for the new women's spot. And, you know, that was the case, then I believe that I have a chance, a better chance in the new women's spot. And I think also with the work that I've been doing over the years with female empowerment and my work in the Gulf with female leadership, I think, you know, branding wise, it's where I want it to be.
With the few minutes we have left, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about yourself? I think you have a very interesting background. So maybe tell us a little bit, first of all, your background before you came to Israel.
Sure. So I'm an immigrant from Gibraltar. Gibraltar is a little British protectorate in southern Spain. I come from a political background. My father was a politician in Gibraltar. He was the first mayor of Gibraltar and then became the first chief minister of Gibraltar, which is a head of government. And so I grew up in a home of public service. And that's really where what I've always done my whole life. When I made Aliyah, you know, 21 years ago, the last thing I thought I would do is get into the political system in Israel when I could barely speak Hebrew when I moved here. And so for me, it was, you know, acclimatizing to the country, making a success of my previous careers in nonprofit and in business, and, you know, getting an opportunity to serve as a city council member for the city of Jerusalem, which I've now been in for 6 years, and deputy mayor for almost 4 years. And so I felt that this was time to make the move to national politics. I feel that, you know, I've spent the last few years representing Jerusalem, representing Israel around the world. I've got some, you know, nice achievements in that field, diplomatically, etc. And I really felt that it was the time for me to be able to serve my country from a national perspective.
And what drew you to Likud? Why did you choose to run in Likud and not try to join a different party?
I don't like the idea of somebody deciding where I am on a list. I like the idea of the democracy in the Likud. And let's be honest. I mean, I've always been right wing, but let's be honest. You know, when you didn't do the army in Israel, when you don't have friends from school in Israel, when you don't have those inherent connections by growing up here, you know, what choice does somebody who has political ambition in this country in terms of the right wing? Yair Lapid, who's not right wing to begin with, but let's say he was, he's a complete dictator in his party. He picks where you are. You know, I have a good friend who was on his list, very high up number. One day he decided to flicker to the bottom of the list, and she had absolutely no power to stop that. So I never liked the idea of parties that have absolutely no mechanism for democracy. I like the idea of building up my own strength and building up my own power. And of course, being in the largest party on the right wing, that's the Likud. And I have to say, I joined the Likud and I also felt very embraced by people. People are warm. People are kind. Of course, you've always got the extremists making the noises. But most people in the Likud are good people, decent people, loyal people. And I found a very kind of warm embrace when I joined.
All right. That's Fleur Hassan Nahum running in the Likud primary next week. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Lahav.
Our next guest this week is Yaya Fink, who is a longtime activist on socioeconomic issues, was an advisor for Shelly Yachimovich for some time, and now he's running in the Labor primary, and we're here to talk to him about that. So first of all, I want to ask you about the primary system more broadly. Some of the leading parties in this country don't have primaries at all. They just have a leader who picks who runs. And they defend that by saying that the primary system is an opening for corruption. Why do you, I mean, you're running in a primary, so I assume you support it. And so why is that? What do you think is good about a primary system?
Look, I think that politicians need to be dependent. They need to be dependent on the public. And when you have politicians that are only dependent on like one person or a few, so I think that's the way to corruption. When you owe your, let's say, your job for dozens of thousands of Israelis. I was yesterday in Be'er Sheva, and tonight I'm in the north, And a few days ago, I was in Afula and Haifa and all over Israel and in Kibbutz Be'eri. So I think that's democracy. Democracy is giving the people the strength and letting them to decide. So I think that that if we support democracy, and if we want democratic values to be part of our political system, we need to support primary and voting by the people.
You you were born in Jerusalem. You live in Yafo today. You represent a small group of religious Zionist Israelis that lived in Jerusalem. Many of them are in very high positions in different sections of Israeli society. But the question is, is there actually a mandate or two or even more of people who consider themselves, I would say, maybe religious Zionists, who grew up in religious Zionist institutions, but on the other hand, will vote for a left-wing party or for a very social party?
When Israel was founded, so there was a very strong, relationship between the labor movement and the religious Zionist movement. It's even called the historical bridge between the two parties. And I believe that we could rebuild this relationship. I know that today most of the religious Zionist people are in the right, maybe even in the extreme right. But also today, it's around 80,000 or 90,000 people between 2 to 3 mandates that don't feel belong to Ben Gvir and Smotrich and Ayelet Shaked, and their center left in their views. And they remember that the most repeated verse in the Bible is that we need to remember that we were strangers in Egypt. And seeking after peace is a very Jewish value. And fighting against corruption or against the socioeconomic gaps, that's about Judaism. And I think that the Labor Party and the moderate religious Zionist movement could rebuild this bridge and contract.
Which, by the way, there used to be the Meimad party, right,
The Meimad was later. Meimad was later, and they got between a mandate and two. But when you go back to the 40s and the 50s, and even to the 60s, so there was a very strong link between the religious Zionist movement and the labor movement, and I want to rebuild this link.
I mean, the link, I think, has a lot to do with. Or the breaking of that link has a lot to do with settlements, when religious Zionism became so strongly identified with the settlement movement. So do you think that that's something that can be broken, or can be that there's enough of a segment of the religious Zionist community that is not as interested in that topic or prioritizes other things?
Yeah, first of all, they could prioritize different things. I go back to our basic values and tradition. So socioeconomic issues are in the top priority in our tradition, and to fight for the needy and for people not to be, people that are weak, to fight for the weak link. It's a very Jewish value. And also I want to talk a little bit about the settlements. You're correct when you say that was the tipping point. But I do think that when you go back to our tradition, so the holiness of life is more important than the holiness of land. Of course, the holiness of the land is important in our tradition, but the holiness of life is even more important. So I want to rebuild this message that you could be religious, a religious Zionist person. You could be a very Jewish tradition person, a Zionist, and want to fight for the holiness of life and not only for the holiness of land. And I think that also today there's about two mandates of the religious Zionist movement that could agree with this message. And I hope maybe in a year or 5 years or 10 years to try and to expand this message. But I think also towards the November 1st election, I believe that if I will get in a high position in this primary, I believe that I could bring between half a mandate to a mandate of religious Zionist people that will vote for the Labour Party.
I read in a piece in Ma'ariv where you're interviewed, you said you represent kind of the real or the true Judaism. And I'm curious, you know, different issues that you want to promote regarding religion and state. There was a very big difficulty to promote them in the past government, where finally, you know, after many years, the Labour was part of the coalition as a party. Yeah. And, you know, even like, you know, the Kotel compromise, which is something that, you know, when I was asked on the radio, you know, like Haredi radio channels, when this government was, you know, sworn in, I said, you know, that's going to be one of the first and easiest things to do. And even that, which is not as difficult as like marriage or kashrut, wasn't able to pass. So, I mean, in what sort of a government will you actually be able to promote your agenda regarding religion and state?
Yeah, so look, I think that in each and every government, you could promote some of the things. If the ultra-Orthodox parties will be part of the government, so we will need to move to the socio-economic issues that are very crucial for us. And maybe even, I think part of the ultra-Orthodox parties could even support steps that will reduce the conflict with the Palestinians. They're traditionally not part of the, let's say, extreme right people in Israel. And if we will have a government without the ultra-Orthodox parties, so I think that we need to be much more braver in the religious and state issues, because in the end, I think that religious coercion is the number one reason for Israelis to run away from Judaism. And if we want Israelis to be part of the Jewish tradition, and I really want them to love Judaism, so we need to allow limited public transportation on Saturday, and we need to allow civic marriage. That won't make Israel less Jewish. I believe it will make Israel more Jewish, because we have millions of Israelis here that are not religious like me. And I want them to love Judaism. And today, when they think about Judaism, they think about religious coercion or about Gafni or Deri. I want them to think about Arav, Malkior, and I want them to think that the Western Wall belongs to everybody. So I go to the Orthodox side of the Western Wall, but I prefer people coming to the Western Wall, to Ezrat Israel, to the Reform and Conservative part, than not coming at all. And I can't understand why people want Judaism to belong only to the ultra-Orthodox people. That will bring an end to Israel as a Jewish state in 10 or 20 years, because only the ultra-Orthodox people will be in charge and accountability of this issue. So I know that it's pretty odd to hear someone that is religious Zionist and says yes to public transportation and Shabbat and yes for civic marriage, but I believe that that will make the relationship between Judaism and state much more healthier.
So next week, Labor is holding its primary, and you're hoping to get a realistic spot on the list. I think much of what we've discussed is sort of consensus in the party, but what are the fault lines? After all, it's a race where people are running against each other. So what are the issues where people differ, and where do you stand?
So look, as I said, I'm part of the religious Zionist movement. Today, we left Yafo. Today, we live in Yokneam in the north. I want to bring to the Labour Party more moderate religious Zionist people. I want to bring the young generation. I established Lobby 99 and Democrat TV by the social media. Almost 20,000 people did the thing that I think the Israelis hate more than any other thing, and paid monthly donation for the two organizations that I established. So I think that I could bring young generation and I could bring religious people into the labor movement. That's my let's say goal. And I hope that the Labor Party members will vote also for me. We have other great candidates, but will vote also for me next week.
So historically, Labor though was divided into doves and hawks, and there in the 90s and early 2000s, there were sort of the more socialist side and the more neoliberal side. It seems these days that it's doves and socialists only, and that the other sides have been taken over by, I don't know, Yesh Atid, blue and white. Do you think that's the case?
I think it's partly the case, but I think that we need to fix that. I think that if the Labour Party, if we want to go back to be a strong, big movement, we need to talk to wider audiences and speak also in a very like security message. And then when you talk about Ben-Gurion or Rabin, or our founders of our party, they were for peace, but they were also very for security and guarding our homeland. So I think that the Labour Party, we need to rebuild our message, not only socioeconomic issues that are very, very important, but also security and peace. So I think that's a challenge that we have, and I hope that the Labour Party will be not only in the left but also in the center.
The polls aren't very positive towards the labor movement, and there are discussions about possibly forming a small coalition between the labor and Meretz parties, you know, the extreme left. Are you in favor of that, or do you think that you should still, you know, run separately? I mean, in the past, there were situations where the parties merged for a very short time.
So I'm against merging, and then we also had an experiment just 2 years ago, and the experiment failed. We got 7 mandates together, and today we're 13. So I think it's a wrong idea also politically, but not only politically. I think also ideology. There are differences between Meretz and the Labour Party. We're more, let's say, Zionist tradition, also periphery party. And I want the Labour Party to run alone and to, as I said, to fight also on the center-left votes and not only on the deep left. So Meretz is an important party, but I am against the mergings.
All right, Yaya Fink, thank you so much for coming on to the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. If you enjoyed this week's episode, please forward it to your family and friends and give us a high rating on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back next week.